I'm Andy Bates, part of the team here at KFUO. While you hear me on the air and in podcasts, I'm also part of the team that works behind the scenes to bring you the programs like this that you value. What you hear on the air and in podcasts is just the tip of the iceberg. Listeners like you generously support everything that makes radio and podcasts happen. Administration, cutting-edge technology, software, hosts, producers, and more. You make this happen. Can we count on you to continue this support? KFUO Share-a-thon, now through April 5th, is a great time to show your support and make a gift or make a plan to give for a whole year. Your generosity is important and appreciated, not just by the KFUO team, but by listeners who get to hear and enjoy Christ-centered programs every day. Will you make a gift today? KFUO.org/give. KFUO.org/give. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
Drop everything you're doing. We're starting a new history series with Dr. McKenzie. So whatever you're doing, that's okay. Put it down. You can, or if you're doing something with your hands, you can keep doing that. But you got to listen, because this is a fantastic history series. We're going to pick up where we left off in our last history series with Dr. McKenzie in just a moment. Thanks to Concordia University Wisconsin for supporting The Coffee Hour. You can find out more about Concordia University Wisconsin at cuw.edu.
Live uncommon.
Joining us today, the Reverend Dr. Cameron A. McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and a longtime now guest for our history series here in The Coffee Hour. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back, and I must say that you say I'm a welcome guest. I'm a guest who likes to be a guest, so I think we're good. So thanks very much for having me.
And we enjoy all the history that you share with us. We learned so much in this series. Last time, in our last series, we learned about the Puritan movement in England. This movement greatly shaped the direction of culture in England, government, politics, and religion there as well. So today we're going to kind of pick up where we left off and look at the migration of the Puritan movement to North America. But before we do that, can you give us maybe a short review of what is Puritanism for those who maybe haven't listened to this series?
Sure, I'd be pleased to. Now, I need to warn you that historians always have a hard time finding a starting point, because wherever we start, there's always a history to the starting point.
Sure.
Now, the medieval chroniclers figured out how to do this right. They always started with Adam and Eve, and can't get any earlier than that. But so I'm not going to quite do that, but I am going to start our conversation regarding religion in America, New England, by going back to Great Britain. I mean, after all, if we're talking about New England, this probably has something to do with Old England. And that's certainly true about the foundations of the first British colonies in New England. So we go back to England, and we find the word Puritan first being employed in the 1560s. And this was a clergyman by the name of Oliver Armorud, who defined Puritanism this way. He said about some of his fellow English Christians, "We call you Puritans, not because you are purer than other men, but because you think yourselves to be purer than other men." Yeah. So who were these folks that generated controversy even in the 1560s? Basically, they thought that the English Reformation, which had occurred in the 16th century under the reigns of Henry, Edward, Mary, and finally Elizabeth, they thought that Reformation was incomplete. It still had a ways to go before you could call it a complete Protestant Reformation. Now, what did that mean? You know, in England, there were gyrations in religion from Henry, who got rid of the Pope, but not much else. Edward, who brought in a full-blown Protestant Reformation, his sister Mary, who brought back Catholicism, and finally Elizabeth, who actually settled the Protestant Reformation, largely because she managed to live long enough to settle it, rule from 1558 to 1603. Right at the beginning of her reign, she summoned Parliament, and the first two laws of Elizabeth's reign had to do with religion. The first act of supremacy put herself, the monarch, as the supreme governor of the church in England. And the second one, the act of uniformity, imposed a way of worship upon all the churches of England known as the Book of Common Prayer. Now, her settlement was, at least initially, quasi-Protestant. That is, it really didn't have a confession of faith. But a few years later, they came up with a confession of faith of 39 articles that was significantly Protestant. Scripture alone, justification by faith alone, two sacraments, good works contribute nothing to salvation. And then in terms of the larger issues separating Lutherans from Reformed, it adopted a Protestant Reform position on the sacraments, including the presence of Christ's body and blood in the sacrament. So they had a confession of faith. They were Protestant. But some members of that church, when they looked at that settlement, thought, this could be better. Now, among other things that they didn't like were some of the characteristics of that Book of Common Prayer. It was basically pretty good, but it still had the sign of the cross used in baptism, and that struck them as superstitious, as a remnant of medieval Catholicism wasn't in the Bible. That needed to go. And then they thought that the wedding ring, likewise, medieval superstition, that didn't need to be in the wedding service. That had to go. Observing seasons like Lent with mandatory fasting, using the word priest in some instances for the clergyman, kneeling for the reception of the Lord's Supper, those things bothered them. And so they wanted to get rid of them, and they wanted to purify the church of those medieval remnants still in their Book of Common Prayer. But there were other things as well. The Book of Common Prayer specified that when it came to the sermon, unless the clergyman had a special license from his bishop, he was supposed to read a sermon that the governmental church had prepared for him. And like four times a year, he had to read about the necessity of obedience to the government. And that's what most of the clergymen in England did. They didn't have preaching license. They were just reading sermons. And so, again, some of these folks who were called Puritans thought that's not right. Pastors are supposed to preach. And so we have one Puritan who described the Anglican clergy with these rather unflattering words. He called them dumb dogs, unskillful, sacrificing priests, destroying drones, or rather caterpillars of the word. Not particularly complimentary. So they had an attitude toward the clergy and that this needed to change. They needed better preachers. They were also concerned about the life of the church, the discipline of the church. They didn't like the idea that instead of having all pastors equal, that they still had bishops and archbishops. Again, that was too much like the Catholic. They thought that individual members of the congregation throughout England ought to be under the church discipline of their congregation and pastor. And that meant, you know, Beckham just say, whenever you have a state church, everybody in a community belongs to that church. And that means in every town of England, you know, the town drunk belongs to the church. The guy who's always flirting or fornicating, he belongs to the church. Everybody belongs to the church. And so the Puritan said, this isn't right. We ought to be disciplining these people. We should be excommunicating. That didn't happen all over the place. And so they were concerned about this kind of stuff too. Queen Elizabeth did not like anybody from the lower orders telling those above in the higher orders, in particular the queen, what she was supposed to do and what she wasn't supposed to do. And so dissidents in the church, as well as in the state, were suppressed. They complained. They got nowhere in their complaints. So through the course of Elizabeth's reign, you have this group, they're members of the church, that are unhappy with one aspect of the church or another. And those are the folks that we call Puritans. For the most part, even though they complain, they're still supportive because Elizabeth is a Protestant. When the Spanish Catholics launch their armada against England, they all rally behind the Queen as kind of the Protestant champion. So the Puritans, unhappy about one thing or another, stay in for the most part during the reign of Elizabeth. But that changes, and changes rather dramatically, when we get to the next reign, the reign of James I. And so that's where I want to go next. So let me talk a little bit about how that happened. Elizabeth was the last of the Tudors. She never married, never had a child. So her successor was going to be a relative. And I'm not sure he was the closest, but one of the closest that they could find was actually Elizabeth's cousin, twice removed. His name was James. He was already a monarch. He was the king of Scotland and had been ruling Scotland for, well, he got there as a little boy, over 30 years. He'd been on the throne in Scotland. And now he was going to become king of England. And so just as before Elizabeth became queen, or when Elizabeth became queen, there was change in religion. Some people in the Church of England thought that when James became king, there ought to be some changes in the official religion. And as a result, they circulated a petition among the clergy of England. When it was all done and they submitted to the king, they claimed that 1,000 people had signed this petition. They called it the Millenary Petition. And in this petition, they asked for changes of the same sort that the Puritans had been asking for under Elizabeth and getting nowhere. What do I mean? The Millenary Petition asked for exemption from some of the vestments that the clergy had to wear that seemed to smack of Catholicism, asked that baptism by women be eliminated, asked that people no longer have to kneel communion, that they no longer have to use the wedding ring, et cetera, et cetera. James thought of himself as a pretty good theologian, and he was maybe one of the smartest kings that England has ever had, kind of a strange personality, but nonetheless smart. And so he bought into this. He thought, yeah, we should really take a look at religion again and see if we should make some changes. So he agreed to a conference very early in his reign, early 1604, at one of the royal palaces, this one at Hampton Court in England. Representatives of the Puritan faction, the critics of the established church, were invited. And these are responsible people. These are like Oxford professors. They're members of the hierarchy, maybe a dean or an archdeacon. I mean, responsible members of the church, but they have these concerns. And James had some of the bishops on hand there to defend the establishment. So the conference went on a few days, and the Puritans gave all of their criticisms. And on one thing after another, James would ask, is something like the wedding ring, is that something that's forbidden in the Bible? No, it's not forbidden in the Bible. So it's not sinful if you have it. No, it's not sinful if you have it. Then we've decided you can have it. And so on one thing or after another, James sided with those who defended the Book of Common Prayer simply on the grounds that if it's neither commanded nor forbidden, authority gets to make the decision that they think best. And the authorities in the Church of England had decided for the wedding ring, kneeling for communion, et cetera, et cetera. It was only on one question, I should say there were two questions, one question that made a difference. The question that didn't make a difference had to do with preaching. Puritan said we need better preachers. James liked preaching. He agreed with them. The problem was paying for the education of clergy, increasing salaries so that they could go to the university, etc. And none of that happened very much. But there was one issue that made a difference, and that was the translation of the Bible. The Puritans criticized the translation that had been established under Elizabeth. James agreed with them. He turned this issue over to his bishops, and his bishops arranged for all the scholars in England, Bible scholars in England, Puritans as well as non-Puritans, to prepare a new translation, and they did. It was published in 1611, became known as in America as the King James Bible, and really was the Bible in the English-speaking world from the middle of the 17th century to the middle of the 20th century, and so had a long, long-lasting impact. So the Puritans, in a sense, got one thing, but that was about it. Subsequently, James and his archbishop, having heard the complaints and having decided not to grant any of those complaints, started to enforce strict conformity to the Book of Common Prayer, as a result of which 90 clergymen lost their jobs. Now, that's out of several thousand, so it was not a lot, but there were 90 clergy who lost their jobs. And that, as well as the stuff that had been going on under Elizabeth, prompted a movement out of the Church of England, a very small movement. So I'll pause here for a second and just kind of make sure that we've got this. The Puritans want to purify the church. Some of them, by the time we get to the reign of James, have given up on that project and separate themselves from the Church of England. And so they're known as the Separatists, and they are the ones who initiate colonization of New England for religious reasons. So Separatists break off from the Puritans, who are dissatisfied with the established church, and the Separatists go it alone and come to New England. So I've been going on for a long time. You guys have any questions? Need clarification here?
I know we're going to talk more about Separatists after we take a quick break. I know we have a lot of very interesting history ahead of us. We got a little preview before we started recording, and there's a lot we're going to cover. So we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason, to use your God-given gifts to help others, to live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world, to live a life that's uncommon. Whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan, you'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie about the history of the Puritans, Pilgrims, and the founding of New England. And before we went to break, we had a recap of the Puritanism, King James, and what led to the Separatist movement. So what happens with these Separatists and the move to start new colonies in America?
Yeah, good. I want to emphasize that we are talking only about a small number of the English-speaking Christians who belong to the Church of England. We're not talking about huge numbers at all, both under Elizabeth and then under James. There were some Separatists even during the reign of Elizabeth, as early as the 1580s. And then under James, in that first decade, again, we have Separatists. Usually, this will mean a pastor, an Anglican clergyman who belonged to the Puritan wing, who for one reason or another was convinced that the established church was beyond purifying, is beyond saving, and if they wanted pure religion, they're going to have to do it by themselves. Now, this actually happens in the United States fairly often, and it still has throughout our history, and it still does. You get break-offs from churches all the time, usually led by pastors that say, we want to do it the right way, and the establishment's not doing it the right way. So we're kind of used to this idea, and we don't think of, we might like it, but we don't think of it as something illegal or anything worse than that. But it was illegal in England in the 16th and 17th century. And what you were doing, in a sense, was saying, not only can we do it better, but what we're leaving behind is not Christian. And that means England's not Christian. And it raises all kinds of questions about whether you're going to be obedient to the established government or not. So it was a serious matter. Anyway, it was in the first decade of the 16th or 17th century. James is king. Hampton Court has happened. We get a handful of folks deciding that they're giving up in the Church of England. And it was in the north of England, in a little town called Scrooby, that a former Anglican clergyman by the name of John Robinson organized a little separatist congregation that met at the home of one William Brewster, who was the postmaster of Scrooby. He was an important country gentleman, and he followed Robinson out of the Church of England. Now, Robinson was a graduate of Cambridge University. He had been a minister in Norwich, but he had been suspended from the ministry for nonconformity. And that simply meant that either he wasn't wearing the required vestments, the surplice, or else he wasn't following the book strictly. So he got caught up in a little bit of persecution, was suspended from the ministry. And he helped to organize this congregation in Scrooby. All right. Now, this was illegal. The church courts were cracking down, or at least cracked down on this little congregation. They had about 100, 125 members. And Brewster, he was one of the elders of the congregation, was actually thrown into prison for a while. So this little group, with their pastor, Robinson, decided that they were going to leave England. Now, where do you go? Initially, they just went across the English Channel in the North Sea to the Netherlands. The Netherlands had a degree more of religious liberty than did England. And so they were able to form a little congregation, and other separatist congregations did there too. And they they settled in Leiden, which is a part of the Netherlands today. It was a university town. It was welcoming, as far as welcoming could be. And the congregation prospered in their situation. However, it turned out to be not ideal. They're there for about 10 years. So let's make this about 1605, 1607, somewhere in there, maybe 1610. Maybe 10, 15 years they're there. And while they're there, they're bringing up their children. And the children are not turning out as well as the parents would like. A fellow by the name of William Bradford, who wrote a history of the first separatist settlement in New England, had this to say. Of all sorrows most heavy to be borne was that many of their children, by these occasions, and the great licentiousness of youth in that country, and the manifold temptations of the place, were drawn away by evil examples into extravagant and dangerous courses, getting the reins off their necks and departing from their parents. Some became soldiers, others took upon them far voyages by sea, and others some worse courses, tending to dissoluteness and the danger of their souls, to the great grief of their parents and dishonor of God, so that they saw their posterity would be in danger to degenerate and be corrupted. So they're concerned about the next generation and what to do about it. I should also mention that the Netherlands were still in a state of war with Spain, from which they were seeking their independence. They were in a 12-year truce, and you would think after 12 years of peace, nobody would want to start up the war again, but that was wrong. And as we get closer and closer to 1621, when the truce is going to be off, the war will break out again. And so these Englishmen did not want to be in the middle of a war between Spain and the Netherlands. So they had lots of reasons for wanting to get out. And so Get Out they did, at least about half of them. They had some contacts with the Virginia Trading Company. And maybe, you know, your listeners will remember that this was the group that had started to settle what became the North American settlements in Virginia, obviously. They had plans for additional settlements, and their board of directors included Puritans who were sympathetic with these separatists and their plight. And so they agreed to go as another settlement of the Virginia Trading Company, so that they could establish their church in themselves in what became New England instead of the Netherlands. Now, it was risky business, so only about half of them went. And the idea was half will go, and if it works out, the rest will follow. Brewster the Elder was their leader. Robinson, their pastor, stayed with the congregation back in the Netherlands, and the idea was that he would join them later. So that's where we get this first movement out of England by way of the Netherlands into New England for religious reasons, and it's a group of separatists, people who have given up on the Church of England.
And I think that's a good place for us to pause or to wrap up this episode. In the next episode, where are we going, Dr. McKenzie?
We are going to New England and Plymouth Plantation, which is what they call their colony. And we'll talk a little bit about their situation there. And then we'll pick it up with Charles I and a much greater migration of Puritans about 10 years or so later.
Our guest today, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, thank you so much for joining us today. Looking forward to our next conversation.
Sounds good. I'll be here.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.